Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, drought in California, is it actually over with all this rain and snow? It turns out in places like Tulare County, declaring the drought a done deal is a lot more complicated than you might imagine. We'll also learn how Fresno County authorities are helping to step up prosecutions against people who try to scam immigrants out of their money. And we'll find out what Valley farmers have to say about potential labor shortages that some say could be looming with changes to immigration policy in the United States in the Trump administration. We start out, though, on the issue of health care. The debate over the future of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is a hot topic in Washington. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of Central Valley residents have found insurance under the law. With the Republican replacement plan still very much a mystery, Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess decided to take a look back at the raw data to see what has changed in the Central Valley.
Before the law's insurance coverage expansion provisions took effect in the fall of 2013, all five Central Valley counties from Merced to Kern had uninsured rates around 25%. That means one in four residents lacked either private insurance, employer-sponsored coverage, or government health insurance through Medicare or Medi-Cal. So how many people have gained insurance in the ensuing 3 years?
We cut it in half. We cut the number of people who are uninsured in half.
That's John Kappetman with the Central Valley Health Policy Institute. He says the bulk of the decline came from enrollments in Medi-Cal, which is government health insurance for the area's poorest residents. The law allowed single, childless adults to enroll. They had previously been excluded. All told, according to data from the state, the entire valley saw at least an additional 432,000 residents enroll in Medi-Cal. That's almost entirely due to the law's Medi-Cal expansion, of which the federal government is currently paying 95% of the bill. Kappetman says that translates into roughly $2 billion a year in additional healthcare spending.
It's a lot of money. And it may be more because we've had more of the Medicaid expansion here than relatively to other places. There are more people that fit in the category. And our health system was relatively less richly funded compared to other parts of California, so that money made more of a difference.
Additionally, according to data from Covered California, which runs the state's insurance exchange, another 67,000 people enrolled in subsidized private insurance. You might have expected that number to be higher, but experts say this is all about the valley's income distribution. There were a lot of poor people, but relatively few previously uninsured people who met the exchange's income guidelines for subsidized insurance. Linda Duchesne, the deputy director for Medi-Cal in Fresno County, says enrollment exceeded their expectations.
But the takeaway is that we had a population here in Fresno County that had this uncovered, you know, we couldn't even fathom the number of people who really needed health insurance that were not already accessing it.
Duchesne says they had to add additional staff to handle the increased caseload. That appears to be true across the valley's healthcare industry. A new study by the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education estimates that the law saw the valley healthcare industry add 17,000 jobs over the last 3 years. Researchers say even with the recovery from the Great Recession, only the ACA could count for such a specific jump in employment in one industry. There are some factors in the law that are somewhat harder to measure but are frequently cited as downsides. Primarily, the requirement that employers with more than 50 employees provide insurance to any worker who works more than 30 hours a week. The law determined that mark to be full-time. Business advocates, especially for small business, argue that this requirement is an expensive burden that harmed economic growth. They say that businesses cut schedules to keep employees under the 30-hour threshold, mostly for part-time employees who are the most economically vulnerable. Or they stopped hiring to stay under 50 employees and avoid the expensive employer match that's required when offering insurance to an employee. It's likely true that some businesses took these steps or struggled to make the balance sheet work when required to offer insurance. However, this is difficult to measure in raw data, since it would be proving a negative of jobs not created due to the law. There's also the matter of more people attempting to visit the doctor when the Central Valley already had a doctor shortage that long predated the ACA's coverage expansion. Michelle Kiyogi with the California Academy for Family Physicians says it's like the state added more parking permits, but not any more parking spaces.
So what you have are patients with an insurance card, but they don't have access to get the right care at the right time all the time. And I think you've seen a rise in emergency room visits because that primary care relationship, that promise hasn't been delivered.
It is true that emergency room visits have increased, which goes against the pre-passage prediction by supporters that ER visits would decline. Additionally, the state of California reduced Medi-Cal payments in the midst of the recession that coincided with the Medi-Cal expansion. Lower payments do little to encourage doctors to take on low-income patients, since state reimbursements often don't cover the expense of care. The Central Valley also has a high percentage of undocumented adults who remain locked out of coverage expansion entirely. All these raw numbers also leave out the impact of other provisions in the law. Among them, the removal of lifetime benefit caps, requiring insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions, and the great simplification in shopping and comparing insurance plans. Whatever the Republican Party decides to propose as a replacement, the numbers piled up by the ACA over the last 3 years will most likely be the benchmark many people use when deciding if it's a change for the better or the worse. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. A new analysis of information about death rates in California has very interesting and ominous implications for the southern San Joaquin Valley. Alcoholism, drug abuse, and suicide are increasing at rates among whites in the region at what some physicians and researchers are calling shocking levels. So what's behind the numbers and the increasing mortality rate among this population? Joining us on the phone now, we have two members of the team that helped produce this study. On the phone, we have from the California Endowment, Dr. Anthony Eiten. He's the Senior Vice President with the Healthy Communities Initiative. And also with us from Virginia Commonwealth University, Dr. Stephen Wolf. He's the lead author of the mortality rate study and is the director of the university's Center on Society and Health. And we should note the California Endowment is a supporter of Valley Public Radio as well as other public radio stations. I want to start with you, Dr. Wolf, because we're looking at this data. You're calling it an epidemic of white death, but it's more precise than that demographically speaking. Exactly who are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about young and middle-aged whites. We've made some progress health-wise with controlling the kinds of chronic diseases that affect older Americans, but among non-Hispanic whites in California who are young, by that I mean age 25 to 34 years, or middle-aged, in particular 40 to 64 years, we are seeing a slowing in the improvements in health, and in areas of the Central Valley, an actual increase in death rates in this population. So more people are dying per year in those age groups than did previously.
Now, let's maybe step back a little bit. For years, the overall mortality rate in the U.S. has been dropping, but now, recently, we saw that change. Can you provide a little more context nationally and historically?
Well, even internationally, in all industrialized countries, we're seeing gradual improvements in life expectancy and decreases in mortality and health problems from these various disorders. However, we are seeing an ominous trend among white Americans, especially women and women of and whites of low socioeconomic status, where we're seeing a flattening of those curves, and in some groups an actual increase in death rates. Just recently, the federal government reported the first time in many, many years in which life expectancy for the nation actually decreased after years and years of year-by-year increases in life expectancy.
So you're looking at the mortality rate in the population at large. You aren't seeing these things in more diverse communities, though. What's happening there in, say, the Latino communities, the African-American communities, Asian-American communities? Are those going in a different direction?
Well, our study focused on this disturbing pattern among non-Hispanic whites. Obviously, people of color, especially African-Americans, are experiencing higher death rates than white Americans do. However, their death rates are decreasing. So we're seeing a trend in the right direction. Same for Hispanic Americans. We're seeing a general decrease in death rates. Having said that, the causes of death that we're seeing occur among whites are also affecting people of color. In effect, the phenomenon we're seeing among whites is a canary in the coal mine. We see a change happening here that is very concerning.
So let's dig a little deeper here into what exactly these causes of death are. Are we talking cancer? Are we talking heart disease? Or are there other things going on?
Well, there's actually progress being made with regard to the leading killers in our country, like heart disease and cancer. Of course, we're aware that diabetes rates have been increasing because of the obesity epidemic. But the disturbing pattern that we're seeing here is a sharp rise in deaths from drugs, alcohol, and suicides. Not only in the middle-aged whites that I mentioned, the age 40 to 64-year age group, but young white adults, 25 to 34 years old, dying at dramatically higher rates, not only from drugs, we're all familiar with the opioid epidemic, but also from alcohol poisoning, liver disease from alcoholism, and a sharp rise in suicide rates.
What types of increases are we talking about? I don't need to get necessarily into every category, but are these 5%, 20%? What types of increases are we seeing in many of these categories?
The increases, I wish, were the rates you just said. They're stunning increases. Accidental drug poisoning increasing by more than 150%, so more than doubling since the 1990s. Viral hepatitis, a complication caused by the use of injectable drugs, increasing 178%. Similar increases in other conditions, suicide rates, in not involving firearms. So we're talking about people committing suicide by hanging, poisoning, falling. Increased by 87% and these are all statistics in the Southern Central Valley. I'm not talking about national or statewide data. This is in the Southern Central Valley.
Your study is ongoing as you continue to look at these deaths across California and the U.S. Do you expect to find similar data beyond this region, or is this very much a localized issue?
No, it's happening elsewhere in the state. Our full report will be coming out soon, and we're seeing similar phenomena happening in other parts of the state, typically in counties that are struggling with difficult economic challenges like the ones facing the Southern Central Valley. These are areas with stagnant wages and incomes, increasing poverty rates, and our concern is that the pattern we're seeing is a population in despair, struggling with very difficult economic conditions and resorting to alcohol or drug use to deal with the physical and psychic pain that they're dealing with, and in some cases resorting to suicide in desperation.
That voice you hear is Dr. Stephen Wolfe. He is the lead author of a new study that's actually currently ongoing. It's preliminary data that we have now specifically on the San Joaquin Valley as they're looking beyond this region as well as the mortality rate study. He is with the Virginia Commonwealth Center on Society and Health. Joining us also on the phone, we have from the California Endowment, Dr. Anthony Eiten. He is the Senior Vice President for the Healthy Communities Project, which is a project with the Endowment focusing on a number of communities across California. Dr. Eiten, the Healthy Community Strategy has done a lot of work on communities of color and disadvantaged communities. How does this report fit into your overall strategy there?
Well, good morning. Yes, this is a phenomenon for us that became very interesting because our strategy had been focused on primarily low-income communities of color whose health statistics had shown significant disparities across the state. And so our goal was, because our mission is to improve the health status of all Californians and to increase access to health care for Californians, our goal was to try to close that disparity gap by working in communities that had high populations, you know, with disparities that were, you know, constituted of low-income Latinos, low-income African-Americans, low-income immigrant Asians, and a whole group of Californians who have been struggling to pursue healthy resources. When we started to hear about this national phenomenon of so-called deaths of despair amongst working-class white populations, we became interested in looking in California to see how this phenomenon was manifesting itself in California. And that's how we decided to engage Dr. Wolf's group. And the big takeaway for us is that these deaths are preventable. These are the kinds of causes of death that are amenable to good access to primary care, to mental health services, to substance abuse treatment services. And these are the very services that are in jeopardy now of being withdrawn under the, you know, the efforts to sort of pull the Affordable Care Act out from underneath Americans.
So looking at that overall issue as far as how do you respond to that, Dr. Wolf, how does the medical community take data as sobering as this and then craft some sort of response? Where do you see that going?
Well, the medical community and frankly, many policymakers tend to be drawn to what I would call the distal end of the problem, treating the symptoms, if you will, of the phenomenon we're talking about. So, for example, the opioid epidemic is forcing a lot of urgent policy decisions about providing Narcan and other drugs to EMS units that respond to overdoses in the field, providing improved addiction treatment services. We can talk about how treatments can be improved for people suffering from alcoholism. But the larger message that we're seeing in this trend is to step back and look at why it is that so many people are resorting to these behaviors, including suicide, and address those upstream root causes that may be largely responsible for a set of behaviors that are harmful to health. And that actually brings us to questions about economic policy and programs to improve jobs, employment, stable incomes, living wages, educational opportunities, and so forth. Because it's the lack of these opportunities for social and economic mobility, which have been present for a long period of time for these families, that are driving people toward these behaviors. And these tend to be policies that aren't undertaken by the medical community, but by our elected officials.
So I want to ask this next question of both of you. Dr. Wolf, first, what's the next step for you? This study is ongoing. How do you see it progressing, and what's the next step from your perspective?
Well, we're rushing ahead to complete the analysis for the whole state because we think it'll be important to the leadership and public in California to know where this is happening, which counties are affected, and which population groups are being impacted. We're looking at non-Hispanic whites initially, but we will complete the analysis for other racial and ethnic groups. But we're also planning to repeat this analysis in other states around the country, in the Midwest, on the East Coast, in different parts of the United States. We suspect that many of the same phenomena that are happening, for example, in the Central Valley of California, are happening in other areas of the country where we have large rural white population struggling with economic marginalization. And we hope that the leadership in those states, as well as our national leadership, will understand that addressing these root causes is literally a matter of life and death for these folks.
And Dr. Wolf, before I move on to Dr. Eitan, Dr. Wolf, were you surprised by this data? Was this a hypothesis you already had, or was this truly surprising?
I was surprised by the data. We went into this obviously anticipating a rise in death rates from drugs. That's been in the news quite a bit. We had a hypothesis that other kinds of stress-related conditions might also be on the rise, but we were totally unprepared for these huge numbers. I've not seen anything quite like it.
And Dr. Eitan, your response to that, and also what's the next step before we go?
I was shocked by this data, completely shocked. The scale of death is unprecedented. I mean, some of the comparisons, to help you get a sense of the context of this, the total amount of deaths in the U.S. from the HIV/AIDS epidemic is about the same number of deaths, of excess deaths, as we've seen in this white mortality wave over the past 20 years. So we're talking an enormous scale. And it calls out, it cries out for policy attention. And the good news is that California has been on the move on various different types of policies over the past several years. I mean, we brought millions of people into health care under the Affordable Care Act. We reformed our criminal justice system to try to switch people who had felonies for relatively low-level crimes to misdemeanors so that they could apply for housing and jobs. We've changed the school discipline system so that there are 40% fewer suspensions and expulsions. And we're increasing access to healthy foods and parks and all kinds of community designs throughout the Central Valley. And these are the kinds of changes that will make our communities healthier and help people see a hopeful future and be able to participate more effectively. What this study does for us is it actually allows us to invite working class whites into the larger effort to try to rebuild our social compact in California and allow more people to have opportunity for 21st century hopeful futures.
Dr. Anthony Eitan is the Senior Vice President for Healthy Communities with the California Endowment, joining us on the phone today, as well as Dr. Stephen Wolf, lead author of the mortality rate study that focuses right now on the southern San Joaquin Valley. He is with Virginia Commonwealth University. Both of you, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and find out why declaring California's drought over is a problem, especially in communities like Tulare County. Plus, a new effort to stop scammers from taking advantage of immigrants in Fresno. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. Right now, though, a reminder about why your support is so important and how you can become a member of Valley Public Radio. Here's how to join.
You can join us as a member at kvpr.org. Just click on that donate button, or you can call 1-800-224-8989. Right now, we just wanted to take a moment to remind you that your membership makes all of this possible. If Valley Public Radio is a source of information for you, if we keep you informed, if clearly classical and music programming keeps you inspired to continue listening, we hope that you will join us with your membership support. We cannot do any of what we do here at Valley Public Radio without you. So your support is very important to make sure that great news coverage comes to you each and every day. Again, the way to get in touch with us here at Valley Public Radio is by going online to kvpr.org and clicking on donate. If this is programming that's important to you, if Valley Edition is something that you really value in terms of staying informed on what's going on in our communities here throughout Central California, we need to hear from you. We do have some great thank you gifts available for your membership gift. We can provide you with a 12-ounce bag of Valley Edition coffee. That's from Lana Coffee in Fresno, your $10 per month sustaining membership gift. You can try out that great local coffee that a lot of folks are enjoying already, I imagine. So we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-224-8989 or go online to kvpr.org. You can take a look at all the great premiums that are available there to you as a thank you for your support of the station. And we will be with you over these next 7 days with this membership campaign. We're raising $125,000 to support the programming that you rely on. So we want to hear from you right now. 1-800-224-8989, kvpr.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Much of the state has received record levels of rain and snow so far this year, and in Northern California, there are signs that the drought may be coming to an end. Things like full reservoirs, record snow levels, and flooding. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, much of the region remains in extreme drought.
All this talk of the drought nearing an end has me wondering whether this is just all wishful thinking. UC Davis water expert Jay Lund says that depends on where you live.
We're not going to be so hard-pressed for the most part this year in providing water for most of the state. There'll be some places, actually down in Tulare County will be one, that won't get all the water they would like.
Recent storms are filling reservoirs across the state, and the ample snowpack could bring a steady flow of runoff later this year. But even still, Lund says areas like Tulare County are in a predicament due to overpumping of groundwater, which could take years to build up again. Lund says that means no matter how much precipitation Central California gets, the drought isn't ending here anytime soon.
I think it's arguable that in some parts of the Tulare Basin, you might never recover that groundwater that was depleted during this drought. And the value of surface water that you would like to have some ways to recharge the groundwater is so valuable in the immediate year that you very little of it will make it to recharge.
Eastside citrus grower Bob McKellar knows this all too well. 5 out of 6 wells on one of his plots of land went dry last year. With all the rain, he's trying to stockpile water in the earth underneath his farm to avoid the same thing next year.
The water's coming down the St. John River and the Kaweah River, and all of our ditches are full, and almost all of that water is going back into the ground. So what we're getting right now is quite helpful. It'll be part of the answer.
Still, McKellar says he's not that optimistic that farms like his will be allotted enough water stored in reservoirs this year. For him, the drought isn't over.
There's two parts of the drought. The weather, and the other part of the drought, as far as farmers are concerned, is due to government regulations. Even if all the reservoirs were chuck full, a lot of that water is going somewhere else.
He's referring to salmon restoration efforts on rivers and growers with rights to water before him. McKellar's not alone in this struggle. Westside melon and vegetable grower Joe Delbasque says he loves the extra moisture, but says he'd be surprised if he has enough water come summer for his crops. His water supply comes from Northern California.
If we don't have that water, we're in a drought. With all of this precipitation we've got, we're not going to get our full amount of water. We haven't been able to get water effectively across the delta into San Luis Reservoir.
That reservoir is currently about 70% full. Del Bosque says more needs to be done to build up water levels underground in the short term. There is some planning under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, but any decision is years out, prolonging a remedy for the deficit of water in the earth under our feet.
We've been extracting it at a pretty good clip the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. And only this year is some of that moisture starting to go back. I don't think we're seeing enough of that.
That lack of groundwater recharge isn't just a problem for farmers. Whole communities are still dealing with the issues of dry wells, due in part to the lack of groundwater recharge. There are still about 400 homes with dry wells across Tulare County. Andrew Lockman is with the Tulare County Office of Emergency Services.
We are continuing to get dry well reports. And the thought was, okay, they're not going to have people going dry in winter when hopefully we're getting rain. And that's not shown to be true. So we actually have people that have gone dry, December and January.
Lockman says it could take years before precipitation that falls today fills the groundwater deficit in Tulare County.
Think about how long the water takes to percolate into the soil. If you're in an area where it's going to take 2 years, we have this great rainfall, the rivers are running and everything right now, at the beginning of 2017, that may end up in your well in 2019.
That means people in Tulare County may have to deal with drought conditions for years to come. Lockman says the only real solution to all this is to stop talking about groundwater recharge and to actually set aside water for restoring these aquifers today. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition. Back in November, Fresno County residents may remember a phone scam following the accidental shooting of Sheriff's Deputy Rod Lucas. Residents were receiving phone calls asking for donations on the deputy's behalf, even though the sheriff's office says it would never solicit donations by phone. Consumer fraud like this isn't new, but research suggests that some San Joaquin Valley residents are prime targets. And as Carrie Klein reports, new efforts from law enforcement aim to stem the tide.
Jenny Rodriguez knows immigration policy. She volunteers from her home in Northwest Fresno to help immigrants navigate the system. She retired from her job as an immigration officer in September, but some days it feels like she's still working.
A lady calls me at 5:59 a.m., had a question about citizenship.
She logs all her calls in a thick notebook full of scribbles and sticky notes.
She wants to become a citizen, which is great. I'll take a citizenship call at any time, day or night, 24/7.
But a call a few months ago took Rodriguez by surprise. A woman complained about a consultant who had promised to get her son a work permit. But the consultant disappeared with $1,200 from the family. The consultant had said she was working with Rodriguez, who had never heard of her.
I was dumbfounded. I'm very, very seldom speechless. I was like, oh my God, I'm telling you, señora, yo no tengo nada que ver con ella. I have nothing to do with this woman.
This case, it's fraud. Over three decades, Rodriguez says she's met hundreds of people defrauded by bogus lawyers and overreaching consultants. And now she's getting more backup from law enforcement. The DA's office has prioritized outreach and awareness about scams, and it's expanding its efforts to prosecute fraudsters. If you look at the data on fraud complaints from the Federal Trade Commission, the San Joaquin Valley actually looks pretty good. Cities here have some of the lowest complaint rates of any of the country's biggest metro areas. So does that mean there is actually less fraud here? Thomas Dadu of the FTC says no. The biggest difference, he says, is our concentration of immigrants.
Overall, our data shows that Latinos report fraud at a rate of 40% less than the general population. And many Latinos are new immigrants.
An FTC report also found that Latinos are victimized far more than whites.
Hispanics were 2.5 times as likely to have experienced debt-related fraud than non-Hispanic whites. And we know that debt-related fraud is often the most pernicious and harmful because it's affecting folks' last dollars.
Deepak Alawalia is an immigration lawyer in Fresno, and he sees these patterns in many of the diverse communities he works with. He says new immigrants naive to our legal system are easy targets, and victims of fraud may be afraid to speak up for fear of retribution.
What breaks my heart is that a lot of the clients that I've met have similar stories about attorneys taking their money, not doing work, or perhaps promising something that they're not eligible for.
Some fraudsters even submit asylum applications for their clients for more fees, even if the clients don't qualify. For vulnerable people with tenuous legal standing, that can cost far more than money.
That starts a whole slew of another legal problems, right? We're talking about being permanently banned from any immigration benefits, because that is the law if you do file a frivolous asylum application.
Sabrina Ashton is a deputy district attorney for Fresno County focusing on consumer fraud protection.
The more that you find out about all of these types of scams, the more that you feel sometimes a defeatist attitude. Can we fix all of this? Can we help all of these people? Can we stop all of this from occurring?
She says she hopes the DA's office can be part of the solution. Her unit is expanding.
It's a really exciting time. We have more deputy district attorneys as well as investigators that are pursuing these crimes. And with that, we're also able to go to a lot more community events and meet with community leaders and get a sense from the public of what's taking place out there.
When you witness any kind of fraud, Ashton says, report it. Call the DA's office or the FTC, and they'll direct the complaint to the agency best suited to investigate. If it's criminal, the DA's office can then work with victims to prosecute.
Hola, 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 hola. Habla Jenny Rodriguez de nuevo.
To Jenny Rodriguez, more attention from law enforcement is great news.
I am ecstatic. I am over the moon with happiness over this issue because this is exactly what we need to be done.
And already, she's found a way the DA's office can improve its efforts. They can make their voicemail message available in more than English. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Here in the Central Valley, it's normal to see California-shaped bumper stickers that say, "My job depends on ag." And in California, agriculture depends on immigrant labor. Lots of farmers supported Donald Trump despite his hardline stance on immigration. As the new administration takes office, the California Report's Vanessa Roncagno checks back with some of those farmers and their workers.
It's after 5 o'clock and dark outside when men in dirty jeans and work boots start streaming into a small record store in Mendota. Racks of CDs and music posters line the walls, but nobody's browsing. The guys are in line to use the store's wire transfer service. They're sending money home to families in Mexico and El Salvador. We just came in from the fields, 9 hours pruning pistachio trees, says a weary-looking guy in a dust-covered sweatshirt. He'll only say his name is Pablo, because like all the farm workers I talked to for this story, he's in the country illegally. I ask him what he thinks of Donald Trump's tough talk on immigration. You think a gringo is going to be pruning pistachios, he says. In 17 years working California fields, he says he's only seen Latinos, mostly immigrants, doing this work. So this idea that he's taking away a job, he doesn't buy it.
We're picking strawberries that are going to go to the farmer's market.
Fruit farmer Steve Murray says he needs foreign workers. I meet Murray on his farm outside Bakersfield, where a few workers are crouched among rows of berries.
Did we finish over here, or yes, did we? When we get a chance, we'll pull the covers over those.
Even though this area has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, Murray has a hard time finding people to pick his fruit. He didn't vote for Trump, and says his business would suffer if the new administration carries through on plans for mass deportations.
When the economy went south, what was that, in 2007, 8, 9, and jobs dried up, there were people that returned to Mexico and didn't come back. It's hard to imagine that things could get much worse.
An hour north, near Porterville, dairy farmer Tom Barcelos is feeling more optimistic. He tells me he met Trump, and he's betting the president-elect's business-friendly side will win out.
Of course, you've heard about him saying you're going to build a wall. But what he told us is that wall's going to have a door in it. And we're going to talk to the right people that want to come in and work, and they're going to have an opportunity to do that.
There's already an agricultural guest worker program, the H-2A visa program, and use has gone up steadily over the past 5 years. But every farmer I talked to complained about it. They called it cumbersome and expensive. So some experts speculate a Trump administration might strip away worker protections and create a program that's more favorable to employers. Barcelo says Trump assured him people who've been working in the U.S. for years will have a chance to get temporary visas, too. But
citizenship, that's a different animal, and let's not mix up the two.
A path to citizenship does not seem likely under Trump. Not every farm worker I spoke with wanted citizenship, though. Take 36-year-old Eugenio. I meet him while he's pruning pistachio trees on a farm near Bakersfield.
I have a family, so I make a little money, and then I go back to Oaxaca, where I'm building a house.
Eugenio says he's crossed the border 8 times illegally, but he says border security is so tight now, he hasn't been home in 5 years.
I'm trying to figure out how to come with a work visa. I'd really like that.
Then there's people like El Fego, who's working on a tree nearby. He doesn't like the idea of visas. He's been here 17 years. His family is here.
What would happen if Trump starts giving visas to people over there?
El Fego worries legal guest workers from Mexico will replace him.
And what happens with those of us who are here? He'll deport us because we're illegal.
Some worry the future under President Trump could bring more raids, or the forced use of E-Verify, a tool for checking work eligibility, or less enforcement of farm worker protections. For now, the only thing certain is that the Valley's $35 billion agricultural economy needs policies that balance the needs of both growers and workers. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in Fresno. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Among the many Californians in Washington, D.C. last Friday for the inauguration of President Trump was Jean Fuller. She's the Republican leader of the California State Senate and a close ally of House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler spoke with Senator Fuller on Friday and started by asking where she sat for the ceremony.
Well, we were seated very close to the front, and President Trump was, I thought, just tremendous today. The whole inauguration was really a moment that made you feel patriotism to your bones. You get there before dawn, and you sit and wait like you do at the Rose Bowl Parade, and then everything comes out, and all of the senators and the House of Representatives and our generals come out, sitting in front of the Capitol, and it just makes you so proud of our nation, just so amazed that this transfer of power can happen every 4 years.
Now, you were there, I'm assuming, as a guest of Congressman Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, correct?
Yes.
So you probably have a unique vantage point to, you know, the changes in Washington, D.C. and how they might affect California. And I'm curious how different to you the atmosphere is where you are right now compared to your day job here in Sacramento at the state capitol.
Well, it's completely different here. I think there's a great sense of immediate action needed and wanted, a change of direction. The crowd was just so many regular people. They were so excited. It was more like a rally than it was like a political town hall. It was like, let's get on with it. Let's put America first.
Now, on Tuesday, you'll be back in Sacramento, and you'll be at Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State address. And you're going to hear a very different message and a very different vision for the state that you represent and also for the nation than what President Trump is representing. Do you think there is any sort of common ground that can be reached?
I absolutely do believe that there's common ground. I believe that in educational excellence, that's an area we can all work on. I believe that in continuing to improve our infrastructure, particularly in water, that we can all work on. I think the areas that we're going to struggle some on are law enforcement and how we deal with cap and trade.
Yeah, we saw the president's nominee for the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, not say that he's going to promise to maintain emissions waivers for California, which probably did not make a lot of people happy in Sacramento, but maybe a position you agree with.
Well, I think that's where I'm going to be instrumental. If the Democrats will reach out to me, I think, mediate and work between the federal change of opinion and some of the new Republican policies. And I think that, especially in regard to waivers, I can help work out what can work best for California and our nation.
Yeah, and if I could, just to follow up on that, finally, Senator Jean Fuller of Bakersfield, the Senate Republican leader, the Democratic leaders of California have been very sharp in their criticism of President Trump. Yet they're going to have to find a way to work with them. And particularly, I think, on the infrastructure package, California will really want to get some money out of that. Is there a danger, do you believe, with the strong comments criticizing the president, that the money might not be available to California as a result?
Well, I think the campaign's over now, and we all need to get down to work. And the danger is that if we don't put all of our ideas out on the table and try to talk them out, some states may be left behind, and California may be one of those. I mean, California is only one of 50 states.
Senate Republican leader Jean Fuller of Bakersfield speaking on Friday afternoon with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler following the inauguration of President Donald Trump. We close our show with a look towards the future. Some ambitious entrepreneurs in Fresno think the Central Valley could be the next big tech hub for the state. Now one company, Bitwise, thinks they're proving the theory with a big new expansion. It will take the company from providing 50,000 square feet of commercial and business real estate to 300,000 square feet, all in downtown Fresno. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess recently spoke with CEO Jake Soberall at the site of a currently empty warehouse that he believes will soon be a hotbed of technology innovation.
So we're at the one building, but today's announcement is really like a multi-site expansion. Kind of
encapsulate what's going on with the growth in Bitwise in downtown Fresno.
Right. So about a year ago, we announced our intention not just to build a single building, but to then begin to add to that and piece together a technology campus here in downtown Fresno. But with that, we didn't want to sort of do it one building at a time. We wanted to assemble a series of projects that made sense and pursue those in concert. And so we announced today three sites. The old Spaghetti Factory, which is going to be titled Bitwise 41, the building we're standing in, the State Center Warehouse, which will be Bitwise at State Center Warehouse, and Hotel Virginia, which will become Bitwise at Hotel Virginia with the addition of the hashtag there. All in all, we're talking about taking the total size of Bitwise to just under 300,000 square feet, 50,000 of which is open, and the other 250,000 or so, which will open in 2018.
That other 250,000, that's the three sites you mentioned. That's the total square footage?
It's about the total square footage, yeah.
Yeah, and the Spaghetti Factory one, the Ventura, that's just like right there, isn't it?
So right. It's literally one building away, and so what you see is the opportunity to develop proximate density, right? The ability for us to have 1,000 people working in this building and another 500 working down the block. And so they pop around between the different eateries and different social spaces. There might be a conference room in this building that they prefer, and so they can come over here and interact with these companies. And that density creates energy, creates community, creates a downtown. And so we want to be very sensitive about how we best create that sort of environment, but hopefully we're not going slow.
And this particular site is going to have, 28 residential units? And is that new construction or is that converted construction in the old?
So new construction. The existing construction will be converted for purposes of technology hub, the retail, and the restaurant. In the side yard to the south of this building, we'll do entirely new construction that will be comprised of 28 residential units together with their own outdoor rooftop entertainment space. We want to integrate the two projects. We don't want to do faux history, right? What we want to do, though, is something that fits and something that shines.
So for people who've been to the Mural District site, it's more of like a communal workspace where small people can rent out bits of space at a time. The Stadium South project's more of like a traditional commercial retail service hybrid. Which one of those do you expect these three new sites to look more like?
Well, so with the new size, you should see both an evolution and then a blending of the different sort of office environments that we've provided so far. The Mural District, we were just sort of space-bound, right? We had 100-square-foot offices and some 200-square-foot offices, so they're naturally small companies. At Bitwise South Stadium, we've got a blend. We want to keep those new and growing companies, but we also wanted to make space for the ones that had grown, and so you get up to about 4,000-square-foot spaces in there. In these two sites, we'll do a bit of blending. Here at State Center Warehouse, there will be a lot of blending. You'll have some small offices, medium, and then some very large ones. At Bitwise 41, there'll be principally medium and large technology companies, so 2,500 square feet to 5 and 8,000 square foot spaces. But we want to continue to put the very new beside established companies because we think there's a lot of magic there in the interaction between the two.
What's the total price tag on the three buildings and the new construction for residential?
I just don't look.
Did you know?
Yeah, I know. So I think all in all, we're going to be spending about $40 million on this next wave of construction. And we're fortunate to have wonderful partners in Paul Queering, Eric Wilkins, Will Dyke, and then the banks that we've worked with, Fresno First, Tri-Counties Bank. We have really wonderful banking partners here in the Valley and then outside of it that believe in what's going on in downtown Fresno and are willing to make real investments. And we have a waiting list right now, about 500,000 square feet worth of technology tenant. They said, we love what's going on. Is there room? And right now, we literally have to turn them away. And so these projects give us the opportunity to build out spaces specifically for them.
Because that was going to be my question. You are fully aware that the biggest problem right now is in commercial real estate in downtown Fresno is occupancy rates very low. But you seem pretty confident that that's not going to be an issue with these projects.
So we are exceptionally confident. We're certain, right? We've built these relationships in this pipeline. There's an important nuance to commercial real estate in downtown Fresno, and that is if you isolate what's been improved to be competitive with other areas of town and other cities, occupancy is almost zero. Vacancy rate is almost zero. There is a lot of property that's going underutilized, but it's also unimproved property. And so as we start to see those things converted, they get sucked up really, really fast. And you see exciting things going on inside, and we hope Bitwise is an example of that.
That was Jake Soberall, the CEO of the local technology and business real estate company Bitwise, that announced plans last week to launch a major expansion in downtown Fresno with 300,000 square feet of space for local tech entrepreneurs. That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email. Our address is talk@kvpr.org. Also, send us a tweet @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hessen, Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.